Have you ever known, I mean, with just absolute undeniable certainty that something was fundamentally wrong with your body?
Oh, yeah. Like you just feel it deep in your bones.
Right, exactly. You've lived in this vessel for, maybe 65 years,
Yeah.
and you're sitting on that crinkly paper on the exam table, and you just know it's
And
failing.
you try to explain it, right? You map out the exact topography of the pain for them.
Yeah, you tell this to the person in the white coat, someone who has, millions of dollars of medical tech at their fingertips, and they just brush it off.
They look at your chart, look back at you, and basically say, oh, it's just a tight muscle.
It's infuriating. And honestly, it's one of the most isolating experiences the human being can go through.
Oh, completely isolating. I mean, you are trapped inside this failing ship, right? You're screaming that it's taking on water. And the engineers are just casually telling you to adjust the sails. It shatters that whole illusion we have about modern medicine.
It really does. We like to think of medicine as this flawless binary machine, like pure engineering.
Right. You put in a symptom, the algorithm runs, and you get a clean answer.
Exactly. But the reality, especially if you have a complex medical history, is that the diagnostic landscape is super murky. It's just a heavily biased ecosystem.
And the sheer amount of like psychological and physical energy it takes for a patient to navigate that, it's staggering.
Which is why we're doing this deep dive today. We have a really rare, unfiltered look at a massive medical file.
Yeah, we're looking at the actual raw records of a 65-year-old patient named Timothy.
Thousands of pages. We've got clinical notes, radiology reports, patient portal messages, spanning basically from 2011 all the way to April 2026.
And the mission here is to track this years-long paper trail. It's a trail of severe weight loss and incredibly specific pain complaints.
Complaints that were just systematically ignored by this deeply fragmented medical system, right up until a shocking scan forced them to
They
look.
literally had to be backed into a corner by nuclear imaging to finally listen to him.
Okay, let's unpack this because we really have to understand Timothy's baseline first.
Right, you can't understand the failure without understanding the complexity of the patient.
Exactly. And his history is a minefield. I mean, we're talking about a guy diagnosed with HIV back in 2003.
Plus, he manages bipolar 2 disorder, and he has a really intense hematological history.
Yeah, severe blood clots, deep vein thromboses, pulmonary embolisms going back to 2002.
And then, crucially, he survived a brutal battle with Burkitt's lymphoma in 2021.
Which started in his right soft palate and required some seriously heavy chemotherapy to push into remission.
So you have to imagine being a doctor pulling up that chart.
Right. If I'm a physician and I see HIV, bipolar, blood clots, and prior lymphoma, my brain is instantly saturated.
It's an overwhelming amount of data. You're just looking for the most immediate fire to put out.
But what's so wild to me isn't just the diagnoses, it's how Timothy actively managed his own body.
Oh, his survival strategy was brilliant. It really highlights how deeply he understood his own physiology.
He didn't just sit back, he engineered this physical defense mechanism, specifically his weight management.
Right, because Timothy is 5'10", and for years, he intentionally hovered around the 180 to 200-pound mark.
He even peaked at about 240 pounds at one point. And we really need to stress, this wasn't accidental.
No, not at all. It wasn't metabolic syndrome or like a bad diet. It was a highly calculated choice.
He literally called it his buffer weight. But okay, let's play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
If a patient comes into a clinic, 5'10, 240 pounds, and says, "Hey doc, I'm doing this on purpose."
The doctor's absolutely going to think he's just post-rationalizing obesity.
Exactly. They'll assume he's struggling with lifestyle factors and just, framing it as a choice to feel in control.
But Timothy knew they would think that. He anticipated that exact clinical bias.
He was so far ahead of him.
He really was. If you read the documents he prepared for his care team, he spells out the biochemical reality of why he needed that weight.
Because he understood what trauma does to a chronically ill body, right?
Yes, his history with HIV and the Burkitt's lymphoma chemo taught him a brutal lesson about weight loss.
When you are immunocompromised and you lose weight rapidly from being sick, you aren't just burning fat.
No, you're not getting leaner by a healthy way. You are entering a state of systemic cannibalization.
We're talking about cachexia, right?
Exactly, cachexia, which is totally different from a standard caloric deficit.
Right. Like if I go on a diet and hit the treadmill, I burn fat. But cachexia is a whole different biological nightmare.
It's a complex metabolic syndrome. It's driven by massive systemic inflammation.
So when the body has a severe illness, like an active tumor or a high viral load, the immune system goes crazy.
It floods the system with inflammatory cytokines. Things like tumor necrosis, factor alpha.
And those cytokines basically hijack your metabolism. They suppress your appetite.
But worse than that, they force the body into a catabolic state. Your body aggressively breaks down its own skeletal muscle.
It's harvesting amino acids, right?
Yes. The body thinks it urgently needs those raw materials to fuel the immune response and make acute phase proteins in the liver.
It reminds me of, imagine a city facing an apocalyptic blizzard.
Okay, I like this.
The city knows the storm is coming. Normally, to stay warm, you burn the firewood in the shed. That's your fat.
Right.
But the blizzard is so violent, the furnace needs so much energy so fast, the firewood isn't enough.
So what do they do?
The citizens start ripping the wooden support beams out of their own houses and throwing them into the furnace.
Wow. Yeah, that's exactly it.
The houses start collapsing. You might be making heat, but you are structurally destroying the entire city to do it.
That is the perfect analogy for cachexia. The structural devastation is profound.
And Timothy knew this. He literally wrote in his own medical chart, quote, "Lost muscle cannot protect organs, maintain posture, support transfers, or fuel immune function."
He fully recognized that muscle isn't just for looking strong. It's a critical endocrine organ and your ultimate armor.
So he built this 240-pound frame to make sure that if the blizzard ever came back, he had a massive stockpile to burn through before it hit his vital organs.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes the doctor's reaction to his weight loss so much more baffling.
The green silos were totally full. And then, starting in late 2025, those silos were just violently emptied.
The timeline is honestly terrifying when you look at the raw numbers.
He drops from that high of 240 down to 204 pounds by late fall of 2025.
That's a 36-pound drop in a really short window.
And the floor just keeps falling out. By early April 2026, he is down to an emaciated 168.9 pounds.
We are looking at a total unintentional loss of roughly 71 pounds.
Over 70 pounds. How does a clinic not stop in its tracks when a patient with a lymphoma history drops 71 pounds?
Theoretically, it should be a blaring alarm, but the medical community is super conditioned to view weight loss as a good thing.
Right, because of general societal health metrics.
Exactly. A doctor sees a 65-year-old man drop from 240 to 200, and their reflex is to congratulate him.
They check the blood pressure, the joint load, and just assume he's getting healthier.
They see the number going down, but they never stop to ask how the weight is leaving the body.
And here's the really insidious part. At 168.9 pounds, Timothy's BMI was about 24.2.
Which is considered the holy grail of BMIs. It's right in the middle of the normal range.
So a specialist glances at his digital chart for like 4 minutes before walking in. They see BMI 24.2.
And their brain instantly categorizes his weight as completely fine. The metric literally becomes camouflage.
The BMI masks the fact that he was structurally collapsing because his physical reality was a nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. He was documenting these crazy, drenching night sweats.
And he developed this one symptom that should have bypassed any assumptions about his BMI being healthy.
The cervical muscle weakness.
Yes. The records explicitly state that he, quote, couldn't hold his head up to eat.
Which goes right back to his own warning about lost muscle not being able to maintain posture. He was living his own prophecy.
When the muscles in your neck, like the trapezius and deep flexors, atrophy so much that you can't stabilize your own skull.
You're not just shedding a few pounds. Your entire musculoskeletal scaffolding is literally evaporating.
He even became wheelchair dependent. This wasn't a guy doing intermittent fasting. This was a body eating itself.
And through all of this systemic collapse, Timothy was pinpointing exactly where the fire was.
He wasn't giving them vague complaints like, "Whoa, I feel tired."
No, his portal messages are full of highly specific, localized pain complaints.
Specifically, sharp right-sided back pain. This goes way back.
Right. There's a neurology note from February 2025 for an MRI referral, and the indication says right-sided back pain for 5 years.
5 years of right-sided pain. And then he starts reporting right-sided electric currents.
Body spasms and this really severe intercostal pain, which is pain radiating through the rib area under the left arm.
He's practically handing them a topographical map of his agony, which brings us to the PM&R visit.
Yes. Physical medicine and rehabilitation, April 2025.
This is the moment in the file where the gaslighting just becomes physically painful to read.
So Timothy sits down with Dr. Heidi Fisco. He's shedding mass rapidly. He's got the lymphoma history, the electric pain.
And what is her assessment?
She writes in the clinical notes that he is suffering from trigger points.
Trigger points. just so we are totally clear here, she diagnosed a man wasting away with muscle knots.
Yes. Hyper-irritable spots in the fascia, she noted, taut, tender bands in his back.
And the treatment. What do you prescribe a guy whose neck can't hold his head up because of electric pain?
PENNY-NS, electrical stimulation pads, physical therapy, and, this is the worst part, a Theracane.
A Theracane. That's just a hooked piece of hard plastic you use to massage your own back.
Exactly. They told a man full of tumors to massage his back with a piece of plastic.
I really want to pause and dissect this, though, because it's easy to just call the doctor incompetent, but that's not really how this works.
No, it's rarely malice or sheer incompetence. It's systemic.
Right. Let's play devil's advocate for Dr. Fusco. She's a PM&R specialist. Her whole world is the musculoskeletal system.
She's trained to look for biomechanical issues.
And a 65-year-old guy walks in. He's got bipolar disorder, a long history of chronic pain. His BMI is 24.
Statistically, a patient with that exact profile complaining of back pain, a trigger point is probably the right call 99 times out of 100.
So she relies on heuristics.
Yeah.
Mental shortcuts.
Exactly. That is the very definition of diagnostic overshadowing. His massive, dense history casts a shadow over his new symptoms.
The psychiatric history and old pain issues act like a filter.
The doctor's brain instinctively shifts away from acute, life-threatening crisis and defaults to chronic, manageable pain.
It's like a mechanic. You take your car in, the check engine light is blinking furiously.
Right.
And instead of checking the engine block, the mechanic just puts a piece of black tape over the blinking light.
That's a great way to put it. They just want to clear the smoke without finding the new fire.
But wait, shouldn't the sheer velocity of his weight loss override that mental shortcut?
You would think so.
I mean, if someone says they can't lift their head to chew food, how does a doctor compartmentalize that and hand them a massage hook?
It happens because of how siloed our electronic medical records are today.
What do you mean? Don't they all share the same system?
They do, but Dr. Fusco was likely looking at his musculoskeletal complaints in a total vacuum.
So she wasn't seeing the night sweats or the 70-pound weight loss.
She might not have been synthesizing them because those were documented by the infectious disease guy or the oncologist.
We assume digital systems give every doctor a 3D holistic model of the patient.
But they don't. Each specialist is just staring at the one tiny data point that falls under their specific billing code.
That's like looking at a massive Renaissance painting, right?
Yeah.
But you're only allowed to see 4 pixels at a time on a screen.
Oh, that's exactly what it is.
You can stare at those 4 pixels of blue all day. You can describe the shade of blue perfectly.
But you'll never realize you're looking at the sky above a massive battlefield.
The PM&R doctor was perfectly describing the 4 pixels of a muscle knot, mm-hmm. totally oblivious to the war in his abdomen.
And giving him that Theracane, that's not just a misdiagnosis, it actively causes harm.
Because it gives false reassurance, right?
Yes. It delays real investigation. It tells the patient, hey, we found the problem, and it's minor.
But Timothy wasn't buying it. He knew the reassurance was totally false.
He had to spend an entire year screaming into the void.
Until finally, his oncologist, Dr. Catherine Diefenbach, orders a PED scan.
This was in late March of 2026. She suspected lymphoma recurrence because of the drenching night sweats.
But even then, even on the edge of getting real answers, the system forces Timothy to act as his own final defense line.
The logistics of just getting him safely into the scanner are insane.
Let's talk about the March 19th message. Almost 2 weeks before the scan.
Right. He sends this urgent message to the clinic's nurse practitioner, Catherine Caceres.
He's not just confirming his appointment. He is stepping in to stop a massive, potentially fatal medical error.
He explicitly demands that they do not use intravenous contrast dye for the PET scan.
And the level of clinical reasoning he gives in this message blew my mind. He doesn't just say, oh, I'm allergic.
He builds a completely watertight medical argument. First, he cites his history of Stevens-Johnson syndrome.
Let's explain SJS, because it sounds like a rash, but it's really not.
SJS is terrifying. It's a severe, life-threatening, immune-mediated hypersensitivity reaction.
Basically, your immune system's T cells go totally haywire. They start attacking the basal cells of your own skin.
Your skin blisters and physically separates from the dermis underneath. It attacks your mucous membranes, your eyes, your organs.
It's basically an apocalyptic immune response.
Mm.
And Timothy had gotten SJS previously from an HIV drug called Sestiva.
So he knew that surviving SJS permanently alters your immune system. You're primed for massive overreactions.
An IV contrast dye is full of iodine-based chemicals, right?
Which is a huge known trigger for severe hypersensitivity if you have his medical profile.
But he didn't even stop there. He also points out to the nurse that his recent lab work showed a creatinine level of 1.42.
That is such a crucial detail for a patient to catch.
Because creatinine is a waste product from muscle metabolism. Healthy kidneys filter it out.
Right. So when it rises above normal and 1.42 is definitely elevated, it means the kidneys are compromised.
The glomerular filtration rate is down. Mm-hmm. And Timothy knew iodine contrast is nephrotoxic.
It's incredibly hard on the kidneys. So you have this patient looking at his own chart.
Realizing his kidneys are stressed, remembering his life-threatening immune history, and cross-referencing all of that with radiological chemistry.
He literally had to manually intervene to stop his own doctors from injecting a substance that could send him into organ failure.
Or make his skin slough off. He was playing the role of a nephrologist and an immunologist just to survive the waiting room.
It is a profound failure of automated clinical safeguards.
The Epic software should have flagged the SJS and the creatinine the second the contrast was ordered.
But it didn't. Timothy had to be the software. Thankfully, he gets the order changed to NO4 contrast.
And so on March 31st, 2026, he finally slides into the P scanner.
And the results are just devastating.
But also the most chilling, undeniable vindication of a patient's self-awareness I think I've ever seen.
To really grasp the scan, we need to explain how an FDGP scan works when hunting for cancer.
Okay, so they inject the patient with a radioactive sugar tracer, right? Fluorodeoxyglucose.
Yes, because cancer cells, especially aggressive lymphomas, undergo this metabolic shift called the Warburg effect.
They stop normal energy production and just gorge themselves on glucose to multiply.
They're absolute metabolic furnaces. They pull the radioactive sugar out of the blood incredibly fast.
As the isotope decays, the scanner detects it and maps exactly where the sugar is burning.
Radiologists use a metric called the standardized uptake value, or SUV, to measure the intensity.
So, just for context, what's a normal SUV?
Normal, healthy background tissue might have an SUV of 1 or 2.
Okay, normal is 1 or 2. The report comes back, and they assign Timothy a Duvall score of 5.
Which is the highest possible score on the international scale for lymphoma activity.
And the scanner finds a new hypermetabolic mass in his cecum.
The cecum is the pouch that forms the first part of the large intestine. It's deep in the lower right quadrant of the abdomen.
This thing was huge. 7.1 by 6.2 by 8.1 centimeters. That's like a baseball. Or a big orange.
And the SUV, the hunger of this mass, was an astonishing 39.6.
Normal is 2, and his is almost 40. That's not just a tumor. That's a biological black hole.
It was violently consuming his energy, and it wasn't the only one.
Right. They found another hypermetabolic mass on the upper pole of his left kidney.
Plus active lesions in his spleen, his left tonsil, and a new nodule in his right lung.
His body was absolutely riddled with multiplying malignancies.
What's fascinating here is how the scan provides undeniable, glowing proof of that biological blizzard we talked about.
It proved why his buffer weight was completely destroyed.
But the most haunting part isn't even the severity. It's the precise anatomical location of these masses.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And honestly, it makes you want to tear your hair out.
Let's map those glowing hot spots back to his clinical notes from the last year.
Where was that massive 8-centimeter cecal tumor with an SUV of 40?
Deep in the lower right side of the abdomen.
Which is the exact precise location where Timothy had been reporting sharp, stabbing, right-side thinking appendix pain.
Spot on. And the mass on his left kidney, the spleen lesions.
Exactly where he reported the agonizing intercostal pain radiating under his left arm.
He wasn't having vague psychosomatic discomfort. He was physically feeling these massive tumors expanding.
He was feeling the metabolic heat pushing against his internal architecture.
So the tragedy of the Therakane isn't just that it was insulting.
No. The tragedy is that while he was sitting in that PM&R office, being told it was a muscle knot, an 8-centimeter mass was gorging itself.
And a mass that size does not grow overnight. That cecal tumor was the literal cause of his pain for over a year.
It's like complaining to a contractor about a massive foundational crack in your house.
Right.
And the contractor just hands you a bucket of spackle.
Yeah.
A year later, a structural engineer comes out and says, your house is actively collapsing.
The sheer size of the tumor completely proves his timeline.
And the second those PE scan images hit the patient portal, the dynamic completely ruptures.
Timothy's tone in his messages shifts immediately.
He goes from desperate, pleading advocacy to just a cold, furious, meticulous indictment of the entire system.
On April 3, just days after the scan, he fires off a message.
Let me read this. Because you have to imagine the psychological state of a human typing these words.
Go ahead.
He writes, the pains I pointed out, right side, thinking appendix, left underarm rib above elbow. I've repeated these pain shots to anybody who asked, are you in pain? Every visit you anywhere in the last full year now. They are the locations of the hotspots on PET scan.
It is the ultimate I told you so, but delivered from the edge of a terrifying diagnosis.
He sends another one to nurse practitioner Jeffrey Kwong. It just says, I've known since last May that there were problems. Everyone dismisses it.
Which brings us to the core mystery here. How does a highly funded advanced system fail this comprehensively?
How do you have epic software, interconnected portals, digital charts, and still dismiss an 8-centimeter tumor as a back spasm?
Because the electronic medical record has fundamentally warped how doctors interact with patients.
We mentioned diagnostic overshadowing, but the software actually encourages it, right?
Absolutely. The EMR is often sold as this utopian tool for collaboration, a digital town square for specialists.
Right, the idea that the cardiologist leaves a note, the oncologist reads it, and everyone holds hands around the patient.
But the reality, the EMR was built for billing, and it was built for defensive documentation.
A modern specialist has, what, maybe 15 minutes for a clinical encounter?
Barely. And they spend most of that time interacting with the screen. They have to check every box so the hospital can bill at the highest code.
And they have to document their specific reasoning to defend against potential malpractice lawsuits.
It's defensive medicine, and it creates this massive paradox of data.
We have more data interoperability than ever, but less actual visibility.
The infectious disease doctor meticulously logs the CD4 count to prove they are managing the HIV.
The PM&R doctor meticulously logs the trigger points to justify the physical therapy referral.
They are building perfect, legally defensible walls around their own specific silos.
It's the blind men touching the elephant. One grabs the trunk and says it's a snake. One grabs the leg and says it's a tree.
But no one steps back to look at the whole animal. The synthesis is totally missing.
The human being has been fragmented into billing codes. And Timothy realized that.
He realized that to survive, he had to become his own lead investigator, his own data analyst.
Which leads to the final, honestly most awe-inspiring document in this whole file.
The health summary he prepares after the diagnosis.
Yes. He doesn't just passively wait for a treatment plan. He prepares a multi-page dossier titled My Health Summary.
And he creates a highly technical brief specifically for his oncologist. He is doing the doctor's job.
He titles one section, Weight Loss Corrected in Full Documentation. He refuses to let them look at just the most recent drop.
He builds a table. He breaks down the math.
He lists the start at 240, the drop to 204, the plunge to 168.9. And he puts in bold text, this is not 30 pounds, this is approximately 70 plus pounds.
He is forcing them to confront the aggregate velocity of his decline. He won't let them hide behind a normal BMI.
He also outlines exactly why they need to factor in his head weakness and night sweats immediately.
He identifies them as B symptoms. In lymphoma, B symptoms indicate a highly aggressive systemic spread.
Fevers, sweats, massive weight loss. They totally change the staging and prognosis.
He is literally staging his own cancer for his doctors. It's unbelievable.
But the absolute peak of this document, the thing that left me speechless, was about his HIV medication.
The Juluca revelation. This is a masterclass in health literacy.
Walk us through this, because the science here is wild. He was taking Juluca, right?
Yes, an antiretroviral therapy with two drugs, dolutegravir and rilpivirine.
And the instructions just said take with food.
The standard generic advice printed on millions of pill bottles. Just eat a cracker.
But Timothy noticed his weight was still free falling.
Yeah.
He suspected the meds weren't actually absorbing.
So what does he do? He goes to the medical literature and researches the pharmacokinetics of rilpivirine.
And what did he find? Why wasn't the cracker working?
He found out that the bioavailability of rilpivirine depends entirely on the gastric environment.
It needs two things, right? An acidic stomach and dietary lipids.
Yes. It needs fat to form micelles, which are tiny lipid transport vehicles that carry the drug across the intestinal wall.
So if you take it with an apple or a saltine, there's no fat.
No micelles form. The drug just passes straight through your digestive tract unabsorbed.
Which means the HIV virus replicates, systemic inflammation spikes, and the cachexia accelerates.
And he figured this out entirely on his own. He realized the generic advice was starving him of life-saving meds.
So weeks before the PT scan, on February 12, he radically changes his protocol.
He starts taking the Juluca in the middle of a dense 500-calorie, high-fat, low-carb meal.
He manually engineered the exact lipid environment his stomach needed to absorb the drug.
And it worked. He actually stabilized his immune response enough to halt the weight loss before the cancer diagnosis.
He even gained a couple of pounds back. He understood the biochemistry better than the clinic that prescribed it.
This raises an important question about the burden of survival in chronic illness.
It really does. Yeah. Think about the tragic absurdity of it. We have a multi-million dollar healthcare apparatus.
But this one patient had to act as his own pharmacist to figure out lipid solubility.
He had to be his own immunologist to catch a fatal contrast dye allergy.
He had to be a data analyst to force doctors to see a 70-pound plunge.
And he had to use his own screaming nerve endings to map an 8-centimeter tumor for specialists who handed him a plastic massage cane.
How many patients out there don't have Timothy's ferocious intelligence or energy?
If you don't have the skills of a forensic accountant, do you just fall through the cracks?
Do you just slowly fade away while your chart says your BMI is perfect?
That is the chilling reality. Timothy survived the diagnostic gauntlet because he refused to surrender his bodily autonomy.
He treated his physical sensations as hard, empirical data, even when doctors called it background noise.
So what does this all mean if you put yourself back on that exam table?
The lesson isn't just a critique of bureaucracy. It's a manual for survival.
His meticulous documentation, his refusal to be quiet, his absolute trust in his own body. That is true patient advocacy.
When you know something is failing, you cannot let the system silence your alarm.
The medical establishment will always default to the path of least cognitive resistance.
It is entirely up to the patient to force them to look at the fire.
Because no one lives inside your body but you. We exist in this miraculous era where every heartbeat can be digitized and tracked.
But data is completely useless without the synthesis of human interpretation.
If a patient practically hands their doctors a beautifully documented roadmap to their own cancer, and the system still ignores it for a year,
then the true crisis in modern healthcare isn't a lack of medical data.
It's a total breakdown in the simple human art of listening.